So I want to dive into our topic this evening, the second foundation of mindfulness, which is the foundation of feeling tone, or vedana. This Pali Sanskrit word vedana means both to feel and to know. So it's a kind of quality or an impression of pleasantness, unpleasantness, or neither that we can experience around both mental and physical. When our attention is drawn towards a thought, a memory, a fantasy, a future thought, a thought about myself, that can have an impression that just that thought has some type of sense of like it, I don't like it, I don't care, right? The physical sensation that the attention's drawn towards or that rests on has a quality of I like it, I don't care. If you were to move your attention to the bottom of your left foot right now, or your left hand, or you're to feel the contact of your butt against the chair, you know, probably not so much, I don't care about that sensation. But if you have pain in your hand or at your butt, right, that's an unpleasant sensation. So the idea here is that feeling is a really conditioned state for us, that unpleasantness or pleasantness conditions our speech, it conditions how we act, it conditions our mood, and so on and so forth. And so the Buddha really wanted to encourage us to investigate or to contemplate or to bring to mind how impactful feeling is in our lives day to day. With mindfulness, it's this simple practice really of checking in and being receptive to our present experience in its full range. So there's a lot kind of happening in each moments of experience. You're hearing, smelling, tasting, seeing, feeling, thinking. The present is not a noun, it's not a place, it's a verb. It's all of this kind of sensory information and all of our thoughts that are brought into it. So mindfulness helps us to kind of be able to develop a little bit of a vantage point where we can observe and relate to our thoughts, feelings, and emotions with a little more clarity. And a little bit better of a, better is a strong word, I guess, but more of a creative way to engage with thoughts, feelings, and emotions instead of reacting from our thoughts, feelings, and emotions, being able to respond to them, to almost develop a little bit of that vantage point. And so the Buddha encouraged us to look through these four pastures or the four foundations of mindfulness. I really like the simile of the four pastures because we're, kind of moving our attention through different aspects of our experience. And the first is body or the sensation part of our experience, just the direct and immediate feeling of, our sensory experience, sights, smells, tastes, sounds, and the physical body. And then he's asking us to consider the impression. So the impression is just your primary likes and dislikes. It's the feeling tone. It's what we're going to talk about tonight. And then also then to look at our attitudes of mind, our almost emotional states of mind, or how the mind can sometimes we notice our moods and attitudes influence drastically how we speak and act and behave. So the Buddha is saying, basically look through these pastures, and you can't separate the four foundations. You're not just doing one, but you're kind of tuning into a field or directing your awareness in that direction. And feeling, when we're talking about feeling, this is a very confusing just from a language basis, a very confusing word. In the dictionary, they have 14 different definitions for the word feeling. We have a variety of usages for the word. We have everything from emotions. I feel happy, sad, lonely, afraid, scared, these types of emotional feelings. We have sensations. I feel hot. I feel cold. I feel pressure or tightness. We have attitudes and opinions. Like, oh, I'm feeling pretty good about my odds for the game this weekend, right? I'm feeling pretty good about my purchase I made earlier. So it's almost this attitude or opinion that we use feeling for too. But like I said, in the Pali Sanskrit sense, the term that the Buddha uses, vedana or vedana, to feel and to know. And so it's the basic feeling impression that arises when you make contact with the world. I like it, I don't like it, I don't care, right? So as I make contact with the pain in my knee, I would call that an unpleasant tone, right? There's a quality of don't like. If I make contact, it can also be with mental experiences. So a thought, I could be thinking about a vacation I'm going on next week, and that thought comes with a little bit of an impression of, oh, I like that, I anticipate that, I want that, I can't wait for that, I'm excited about that, right? So there's a kind of an impression there. Your feeling or this impression of your life experience is conditioned based upon a few things. One, your biology. So your nervous system has two drives, really. Get pleasure, avoid pain. Feel comfortable, don't feel uncomfortable. That's what all of your emotions are centered around, is emotions are felt sensations that arise from perceived threats or opportunities in the environment. That's one definition of an emotion. So a felt sensation from perceived. So there's both a mental and a physical quality to emotion. And your system, even before it gets to emotion, there's a primary like or dislike. There's kind of a knowingness of the nervous system to say, okay, good, okay, I hate that, don't like that, want to get away from that. So one of the things that conditions feelings is just your biology. And this is the dilemma in a lot of ways, is that we often, as you see with things like addiction, go for short-term rewards or short-term pleasure, even though it creates long-term discomfort. So it's almost just not being conscious of your reactions or not being quite aware of the basic feeling of your experience. What will tend to happen is you'll move to avoid it and unpleasant, and you'll try to get something that feels good pretty quickly. We see this in our day-to-day lives, and the Buddha didn't encourage this as you should beat yourself up, or you should really anything about it other than just be aware of that and investigate that, because it's important. So biology is a huge part. Also, your feelings in the way that you experience likes or dislikes are largely based upon your past conditioning. So, you know, you may see someone, they talk a lot about this in therapy, transference and counter-transference, how we see people that we may not even know remind us of other people, and how we project onto them, and we then react or relate based upon our projections. Right, and so then the next time you see someone, or when you see some, you may have this initial impression of like, don't like, or don't care, without even really being aware of that. And so everything stems from feeling impression. It's really a simple thing. It doesn't quite get into the territory of emotion. It doesn't quite get into the territory of perception. But, you know, those things are, like I said, with the postures and mindfulness, they're all interconnected. We're not trying to really separate them and say it's one thing. It's all there together. Another way that feelings are conditioned, or our impression of experience or conditions, through our culture and society, right? So you can go, and you notice this when you go to a different, you know, country maybe, and they have a different culture around eating or a different culture around how they communicate or interact. It can throw you off, or there's a sense of not having that norm or not really understanding the structure or the new culture you're in. And so there's a little bit of maybe, you know, can be a lot of responses. Maybe you have some curiosity and you like that, or maybe it makes you feel out of place and uncomfortable. So there's social, there's cultural, there's biological, and there's experiential components to what conditioned feeling. I'm going to go through some of the, like, conceptualization, like I am now, of what feeling tone is. It's not really that helpful, but some people, like, you know, think more with their head than their body, so that's how I am. So it's sometimes helpful to have it if you're into that. So when you're talking about feeling tone, what they're referring to is something called a hedonic scale, which is a scale of pleasure maybe on one end and unpleasant on the other end. And there's a whole variety of different, degrees of pleasant and unpleasant. Sometimes it's taught that there are only three feeling tones: pleasant, unpleasant, and neutral. But the way that the Buddha taught is that there are really only two: pleasant and unpleasant. And what's neutral is really just not registering on the scale. It's right in the middle here, and you don't really pick it up because there's not enough stimulus there to really care. With mindfulness, why this is helpful is that the more that you can actually attune and check into your present experience, you notice that most of your present experience is actually neutral, right? So in neuroscience, they say we have a negativity bias, which is we tend to mostly our attention's drawn towards uncomfortable parts of our experience, or it goes to thoughts of fantasy to try to get us out of the present experience, or, you know, so your mind strategizes and it leans usually towards pleasure or displeasure, and oftentimes it gets caught in the negativity bias, which is to look mostly unpleasant. One of the beautiful things about mindfulness is you can start to come into the direct experience of, oh wow, there's actually more that's okay about right now than what's not okay. You know, so your awareness gets a little bit bigger and your perspective gets a little bit bigger, which allows you to be a little more creative and not so overwhelmed by the discomfort. You can really only be experiencing six things in consciousness. Consciousness sounds like a big thing, but it's really just meaning, you know, thinking, to be awake, aware, you know, the knowingness quality. If I'm here, there's some things happening here. You can be conscious of six things from the Buddhist psychology perspective. Sight, smells, tastes, sounds, feelings, and thoughts. Your thoughts are a big category because they include everything from how you appraise situations, how you, you know, memory, fantasy. There's a whole wide range of things that are happening there. So when you're talking about feeling tone, when you make contact with one of these senses or the thinking mind, there's always some type of impression. If I was to give a complex definition of feeling tone, it would be, it is a conditioned impression that is created by the mind's evaluation of a mental or physical event. So I'll say that again. It's a conditioned impression that is created by the mind's evaluation of a mental or physical event. A simple definition would be, it's the primary impression of likes or dislikes associated with any sensation or thought. Primary impression of like or dislike associated with any sensation or thought. So feelings are often conditioned by our perception of things, how you perceive something. So we often appraise information based upon our past associations and react unconsciously most of the time or habitually to those things as we do. Like, I walk into the room, I see a chair, my impression is neither pleasant or unpleasant. I know the utility of the chair, and so I sit in it. There's not a spike in the chair, there's not a warm bath of, you know, jacuzzi water in the chair, so I'm not drawn to sit in it longer, I'm not trying to avoid it, I just sit down because I know what a chair does based on past experiences. And so when I see a chair, neutral naturally arises, fine, I'll sit there. But if you were to sit in a chair all your life and it was to have spikes in it every time, you would condition a new experience around that. So does this kind of make sense? So then you wouldn't probably want to sit on chairs even if you looked at it and saw it looked fine, because that association's there. So that's all the conceptual stuff I think we'll do, and hopefully we'll work through some practical things. What I've drawn up on the board is what in the Buddha's discourse he calls the second arrow. So I want to explain this a little bit. You're welcome to move if you would like to see, and you're welcome to also take a look after. I'll leave it up. Move this a little closer. All right, so one of the qualities that, or it's really a capacity that we're hoping to develop with mindfulness and the training of the mind through mindfulness is the skill of equanimity, which is the ability to be within your present experience without push or pull. By push or pull, I mean there's a tendency that naturally occurs, like we've talked about, to push or to suppress, to avoid, to become aversive to, unpleasant experiences into pull, which is to experience greed, craving, clinging, obsession, and anticipation around pleasant experiences. The Buddha's main philosophy was basically that you have a dilemma. And the dilemma is that you're born into a world, as the Chinese Buddhists say, you're born into a world that's equally 10,000 joys and 10,000 sorrows. That this existence both has pleasure and pain, gain and loss, praise and blame, status and disgrace, the winds of our existence, that we can't escape this pleasure-pain dichotomy, is a simple way to say that. That we have both pleasure and pain. But you have a biological system, you have conditioning, and you have, you know, cultural conditioning, all of these things that really are encouraging you to only get one side of the coin. But you have both, right? So this problem arises where life has equally pleasure and pain, gain and loss, praise and blame, status and disgrace, but our survival or our natural inclination is to only go after one. What happens is that when you're not aware, when mindfulness isn't present, you have an unconscious reaction. So around pleasure, you know, where you may experience something, you know, you're having a bowl of ice cream with a friend, the clouds are, you know, not to be found anywhere, it's nice and warm, you're having a wonderful day, you know, and there can be a little bit of trying to cling or hold on to that experience. And many of you all probably know what I'm talking about. I call it Sunday dukkha. Dukkha is the word for dissatisfaction in the Buddhist language. And Sunday dukkha means where here we are on Sunday, right? A lot of us are headed back to work tomorrow. So it's kind of like, I'm going to go home, stay up late, eat an extra bowl of ice cream, watch another episode of Netflix. And we kind of try to hold on to or cling after that pleasant experience. With, you know, unpleasant experiences, we have this opposite tendency to become aversive or irritable, avoid, suppress. I feel, and I'm interested in this, I don't, you know, this is just kind of my opinion, I actually feel I have more strategies to unconsciously avoid pain than I have to unconsciously try to obsess or keep around pleasure. I don't know why that is, but there's a whole range, it seems, of like resentment or anger type of reactions to pain. There are also just irritability and like discomfort reactions to pain. And then there are these other really tricky ones where you want to avoid or suppress or try to, you know, not address pain. So the Buddha has a very beautiful, I record this on my phone, so that's why I'm holding this in my face. He has a very beautiful way of describing this. He calls it the second arrow. And so what he's saying is basically through practice and becoming more aware of your conditioning around feeling, you can learn to develop more equanimity or more skillfulness around how you handle pleasure and pain. So it's not just about having the ability to be with pleasure and pain, but to skillfully move through pleasure and pain. So it's not unconsciously, I'm trying to get, have, hold on, cling, and then therefore I suffer because that experience is impermanent and because you can't keep pleasure around all the time. But instead, how do I create some pleasure that's worth creating? How do I move through a pleasurable experience and fully enjoy it and actually be present for it? Sometimes we also have this other tendency, I'm big around this, like I talked about kind of with the Sunday dukkha, is because it's going to end, I can't even really fully enjoy it because I'm waiting for the other shoe to drop, right? So mindfulness really helps you to even fully experience pleasure. And it can be a very beautiful thing, is to be able to become familiar with those parts of our experience too. And so the second arrow is where we unconsciously react. And through our reactions, we actually create suffering on top of the pain. You ever heard the phrase, pain is inevitable and suffering is optional, right? The Buddha is kind of saying that, yes, life, there is painful, there are what they call the inarguables of life, that things change, that because they change, things are difficult because they're uncertain, they're unstable, they're insecure, and that that's not personal, that that's the nature of things. And we oftentimes try to argue with reality. I think it was Byron Katie said, I'm not a spiritual person because, you know, I like to be good or something like that. She said, it just hurts like hell to argue with reality, right? Mm-hmm. And so that's a... I think, in general, the direction that the Buddha is encouraging us to investigate. How do we argue with reality? How can we creatively engage with our life? So I want to read the sutta. It's just a section of it, and it's about this second arrow. The Buddha says, when touched with a feeling of pain, the person without mindful awareness present will sorrow, grieve, and lament, beat his breast, and become distraught. So in this way, this person will feel two pains, both physical and mental, just as if they were to shoot this man with an arrow and right afterward were to shoot him with another one, so that he would feel the pain of two arrows. In the same way, when touched with a feeling of pain, the person without mindful awareness will sorrow, grieve, and lament, beat his breast, and become distraught. So he feels two pains, both physical and mental. So here in the image, I love this image, is he's talking about physical and mental, but we can also create a mental pain and have another mental pain on top of that. Like when you worry or get caught in rumination or obsession, right? Normally there's some very real fear, but on top of that fear, we spin out of control and create more distress on top of it. But I love this image, this really simple image of someone getting shot by an arrow. I like to, when I work with adolescents, I tell them a story about how this guy decides to pick up a third shift job in a not so good part of town, and how he's working the third shift and he gets off around 5 a.m. and he decides to take a shortcut home kind of through the hood. He shouldn't really be walking through there. It's dark out. He's alone. And he gets shot in the leg, and I use the reference to the arrow. I tell him it's 2,600 years ago. And so this guy gets shot in the leg, and someone robs him, and he's laying on the ground, and he says, you know, people run up concerned, and they say, hey, we need to help you. We need to get you to the hospital. Are you okay? And he says, no, I'm not going anywhere until I find out who shot me. Right? This is the second arrow, the resentment or the, you know, and how often do we do this to ourselves where it's like we are almost attached to the pain. You hold it in place. And really, we don't do it consciously, but we get in this, you know, all this. And then he turns in the story, he turns this back on himself and he starts to say, I'm such an idiot. I shouldn't have taken the third shift job. I should have. And how often do we create that second arrow too? And so look for that. That's a good thing, I think, to investigate and to work with. What I want to talk about now is a couple ways to work with discomfort with mindfulness and to work with kind of the unpleasant feeling tone, and a couple ways to work with the pleasant feeling tone, and then we'll open it up. So I lied. I'm going to erase this. It'll be a practice of impermanence if you wanted it.
Can I take a picture of it?
Yeah, you can actually, if someone wants it, you can give me your email and I'll email it to you. Yeah. Anyone know any good jokes? Oh, why can't the Buddhist vacuum in corners? No attachments.
What's the biggest pencil in the world?
The biggest what?
Pencil in the world.
What?
Pennsylvania.
Oh, I love it. Good, clean, fun. You got to be careful with this crowd when you open it up for a joke session.
How do you get a hanky to dance?
A what?
A hanky to dance.
How?
Put a little boogie in it.
Put a little boogie in it. I love it.
Alexa told me that.
I don't tell dad jokes, but when I do, he usually laughs.
Oh, I like it. All right. A little curveball there. Okay, so working with either mental or physical discomfort. one of the ways that you can work with mental or physical discomfort in meditation practice is to shift your attention to the source of discomfort. I've got it right here. So it's kind of a simple description, but you can move your attention to the source of the discomfort to investigate it for what it is. And I'll explain this.
What were you about to drop?
I'm going to put it back up a little bigger.
Oh, okay.
So here's your attention in the front part of your brain. Here you are with... this is pain in your shoulder. Your attention's drawn towards the pain. But usually, instead of being with the pain, what you do is you get caught in what I call conceptual pain, which is, ouch, I hate this. And in this example, your mind could then go to, how much longer in the meditation, right? So let's say you're sitting in meditation, you experience a pain in your back because of how you're sitting, and then there's this kind of, ouch, how much longer am I going to be here? This is painful. There's kind of that label of pain. What the Buddha encourages in one way to practice with pain is to actually move your attention to the discomfort. And what you'll notice is that the pain has a wider field, that the pain is sensation, that the pain ebbs and flows. What is pain? We're so quick to identify or label things, but pain comes with a conditioned feeling tone. When I say pain, or when I think of my shoulder hurts, there's a natural tendency to constrict or to move or to want to get away. So one of the ways, not all of the way, but one of the ways that is against the stream that the Buddha is encouraging is to investigate that the sensation is impermanent, that the sensation is sensation as a verb, that it's flowing and changing. Another way to describe this is if you've ever had an itch during meditation practice and you didn't scratch it. Right, that the scratch or the itch will kind of really well up, and it's okay ethically to scratch the itch. There's nothing wrong with that. You know, no one's telling you to sit here through immense pain, but to spend some time first learning to tolerate or learning to develop this capacity to hold the sensation, knowing that the sensation is fluid, that the sensation will ebb and flow, and not getting so caught up in the story about it or what it is or how you need to fix it or change it. The second way to work with pain, and these are just things that I've found through my own practice, is to open your awareness into a wider field. What I mean by this is, if you're here and you're experiencing pain in your shoulder, your attention naturally is going to be drawn towards the discomfort. With mindfulness, one of the things that we can start to practice is a wider field of awareness. So you start to pay attention to your feet and maybe systematically move your attention from your feet up to your head, and you get this kind of wider space that the pain's being held in. So this pain will still be there, but you have a bigger kind of container in which it's being held. And then what will happen is, yeah, naturally you'll kind of lose that open awareness and you'll go right back to the pain, right? But it's a practice of, you know, that your attention and your mind is so powerful, and you can start to, mindfulness is fundamentally a science of training the attention. And you can train your attention to have a more wide, open type of awareness. There's one, you know, if you look at like Jack Kornfield and some of these folks have something called a big sky meditation, which is where you really focus on the element of space or the sound around you. You widen your attention to a bigger field. One way to describe this is it usually doesn't happen naturally, but it's a good kind of example of how this happens, is when the refrigerator is buzzing, like that one actually is, I think, you don't notice it. Now you will. You don't notice it because you there's much more, you know, it's just a part of the soundscape. It's a part of the present experience. So mindfulness helps you to have a wider container of awareness. The third is to practice shifting attention away from the discomfort waiting for discomfort to subside and become manageable. So this is where I talk about resourcing skills, using practices like metta or opening your eyes during meditation, doing walking meditation, or distracting with a healthy activity. These are ways to work with discomfort. If you chronically experience pain every time you sit and meditate, what you need to do is you need to do something different. Because it's not just about, sometimes us Westerners can have this, I'm going to really do the first one. I'm going to sit with the pain, I'm going to investigate it, I'm going to develop equanimity, goddammit, right? But you want to be resourced around pain. It's a skillful use of your attention to actually sometimes distract healthily. You know, to call a good friend or go for a walk or listen to a podcast. Do something to let the discomfort subside, especially when you're overwhelmed by it. You need to kind of feel a little bit more stable before you can, you know, really have any creative engagement with discomfort. The last around discomfort is to practice what I call the road to compassion. So ultimately, the Buddha's encouragement is to practice that the wise response to pain is compassion, to care for it, to embrace it, to open to it, to care for it, to understand pain. And here we're talking about physical, but obviously a lot of what he's talking about is our emotional pain, our psychological pain. But you can't always just jump in the pool of compassion. So sometimes it's helpful to kind of have road marks. This is the way that I describe it. Is when I'm experiencing something that's really challenging or difficult, like sometimes we'll start by just asking myself, I really hate this fear, this anxiety. You know, I get this a lot around public speaking. I do a lot of public speaking, and sometimes I'm just not primed. I'm not in the mood. I've been sitting inside all day, isolated. I don't really want to talk. And so my anxiety comes in. I hate it because I have this attitude, right, wanting to get rid of it, that it's getting in the way of me being able to do what I should be doing, right? So this is kind of like, this anxiety shouldn't be here, I hate this. And so I'll sometimes just ask myself, okay, I really hate that I'm anxious right now, but can I hate that a little bit less, right? So you're trying to get your mind on board a little bit with like, all right, I don't like what's happening, but can I not like what's happening just a little bit less? And it really is, I mean, it sounds like, well, duh, but it's like really kind of encouraging your mind to head in that direction. And then practicing tolerance. You know, these aren't necessarily steps, but they're kind of how I experience where I'm at on the spectrum. Mercy is when you have the ability to cause more harm or create more distress, and you just choose not to. So these are kind of harm reduction. That's kind of right in the middle, is like, I'm feeling lonely. Can I hate my loneliness? Yeah, less? Yeah. Okay, can I tolerate it? Yes, I've been tolerating it for years. All right, how about I just don't text my ex right now, right? That's mercy. You know, and then you start to invite it in and you feel with. Feeling with is empathy. So just to kind of develop that willingness to feel the loneliness and say, okay, I'm actually going to be here with it. I'm going to feel it. You know, I'm going to hold it for a little bit of time. And compassion is an active caring. So, you know, it's kind of turning the mind. The heart and the mind are one thing in Buddhist psychology. They call it the citta, which is the interconnected heart-mind. Turning the heart and the mind towards this training of caring for our pain. So actually then sitting with the loneliness and saying, you know, I care for you. I feel you. I know you. You know, I wish you to be free from this pain. You know, compassion embodies all of those types of traits. We'll talk about compassion sometimes. So these are a few different ways of working with pain or unpleasant feeling of mind and body. And then I'll just go over, because I don't have any cute diagrams for the pleasure. But I just want to go over real quick a couple ways to turn our mind towards pleasant feeling. The first thing I want to say is the Buddha, I wouldn't get too hung up on this. He talked about both worldly and unworldly feelings. And unworldly feelings are linked to the impressions that we get from, worldly feelings are linked to the impressions that we get from ordinary, pleasant, and unpleasant physical and mental experiences. So, for example, any sensation like the taste of ice cream, the thought of your mother, a mental experience, remembrance of an argument I had yesterday, unpleasant memory, physical pain in my back. These are all worldly, pleasant and unpleasant. But unworldly feelings are linked to progress or regress on the spiritual path. It is the pleasure that arises from engaging in healthy activities or living a wholesome life, or the displeasure that arises from engaging in unhealthy activities or living a regretful life. So one way that I like to talk about this is, you know, in early recovery I learned that self-esteem, they used to say this all the time, self-esteem is built by doing esteemable acts. So if you want to feel good about yourself, you really want to live in line with your values and do things that make you and contribute to you feeling good about yourself. And when you make a commitment to a spiritual path and you're living in line with your values, even though those values can change, but when you're on a spiritual path and you feel supported by that, what happens is this joy of renunciation is what the Buddha calls this unworldly pleasant feeling of living a spiritual life and making progress on the path. Also, when there's a healthy sense that the Buddha talks about of regret. He calls these healthy, I think they call them, you may know, they're called guardians or, I forget the name for them. But Hiri and Otipa are the name in Pali Sanskrit, a healthy sense of shame and regret, which is almost when you do something that's not in line with your values and having that unworldly pleasant of just like, oh, that didn't feel so good, right? That's a good kind of indicator. So one of the ways to work with pleasant feeling is to cultivate more of it by living a spiritual life, living a life that's in line with values, by having a system of structure and support in which you can do that. We forget. Mindfulness means to remember the ground. So we forget our values. We forget what's in front of us. The mind is tricky and slippery. It will go into its reaction state all the time. The more you have supports and friendships, spiritual friends, wise association, service, you know, community, these types of things really encourage the development of more pleasant feeling just around this unworldly pleasure of progress on our path. So also we're developing the capacity to hold pleasant experiences. So this is what I was talking about before. We fall victim to the negativity bias of the brain. It's hyper-focus on unpleasantness or discomfort, and we want to begin to start to, with mindfulness, incline your mind to a bigger picture. This means actually looking for pleasure and looking to enjoy it. This is the practice of mudita, sympathetic joy for other people's pleasure. It helps to combat jealousy. And a non-attached appreciation for the joy, pleasure, and success in my life. To actually look for it, to go after it. And this is really important because if we do have this negativity bias with the, you know, neuroscience is kind of saying is you're going to have to work to overcome the bias. You have to actually look for and to reflect on and to include some of the success, pleasure, and appreciation in your life. We can do this in a formal sitting practice. May I learn to appreciate and enjoy the present experience that I'm in. May I learn to hold this experience with kindness and in gratitude. May the goodness in my life continue to grow. It's just things to really hold in mind. Lastly, and importantly, very similarly related, is cultivate a daily gratitude practice. If you talked to Andrew 2 years ago, would hate this Andrew sitting up here telling you to write a gratitude list. I always felt that, like, I have fallen into what John Peacock calls the myth of authenticity, which is the belief that you have to be authentic about something before you do it. But the problem is that the path of the Buddha's Dharma is not to train, it's not to follow your heart, it's to train your heart. So you have to actually do it whether it's authentic or not. And then eventually your mind recognizes it and it does it more often. And the science actually backs this up. I want to read this. So these are a couple different studies. I want to read them both. They're short, a couple paragraphs. One study by a couple of American researchers assigned young adults to keep a daily journal of things they were grateful for. They assigned other groups to journal about things that annoyed them or reasons why they were better off than others. The young adults assigned to keep gratitude journals showed greater increases in determination, attention, enthusiasm, and energy compared to the other groups. While that shows a clear benefit of gratitude, it also makes a clear distinction. Realizing that other people are worse off than you is not gratitude. So I'll say that again. Realizing that other people are worse off than you is not gratitude. Gratitude requires an appreciation of the positive aspects of your situation. It's not comparison. Sometimes noticing what other people don't have may help you to see what you can be grateful for, but you have to take that next step. You actually have to show appreciation for what you have for it to have an effect. And the second part says, furthermore, feelings of gratitude directly activated brain regions in studies associated with the neurotransmitter dopamine. Dopamine feels good to get, which is why it's generally considered the reward neurotransmitter. But dopamine is also almost as important in initiating action. That means increases in your dopamine make you more likely to do the thing you just did. It's the brain saying, oh, do that again. Gratitude can have such a powerful impact on your life because it engages your brain in a virtuous cycle. Your brain only has so much power to focus its attention. It cannot easily focus on both positive and negative stimuli. It's like a small child easily distracted. Oh, your tummy hurts? Here's a lollipop. So you lost your job? Isn't it wonderful we're having KFC for dinner? On top of that, your brain loves to fall for the confirmation bias. That is, it looks for things that prove what it already believes to be true. And the dopamine reinforces that as well. So once you start to see things to be grateful for, your brain starts looking for more things to be grateful for. That's how the virtuous cycle gets created. So this is how the brain, through its neurotransmitters and its reward, and that's how the brain, through this confirmation bias of liking that reward and then therefore doing it again. Gratitude builds. It's a really wholesome, helpful way out of depression. It's a really wholesome, helpful way out of feeling stuck and overwhelmed. So to review real quick, our relationship to pleasure and pain is largely conditioned by our biology, by our past experiences, by our culture and society. We often act unconsciously with how we're affected by likes and dislikes. We hate, become aversive to, irritable, resentful, avoid or suppress unpleasant experiences or feelings. We are greedy about, cling, crave, obsess, and anticipate pleasurable experiences. We can break free from unconscious habits by working skillfully to creatively engage with these primary likes and dislikes via the development of equanimity, which is the capacity to hold pleasure and pain, and through resourcing, which is how we work with pleasure and pain skillfully. So these are some thoughts I have about feeling.